DC politicians want to enact harmful credit card mandates that could take away your cash back and rewards points. Perks that stretch your budget and make life a little easier. Losing these benefits means less money for your family's everyday essentials like gas and groceries. The perks you rely on could disappear, leaving you with higher costs and fewer options. Tell Congress to guard your card and oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card mandates.
Paid for by Electronic Payments Coalition.
Welcome, Deep Divers, to a journey into the often overlooked corners of American history. Today, we're diving into a question that might just fundamentally change how you think about presidential legacies. What if a president, someone often dismissed as, you know, unmemorable or even ranked among the worst, was actually the central figure during one of the most volatile periods in American history, a leader making choices he deeply believed were absolutely essential for preserving national unity, even if those very decisions ultimately cost him his place in our collective memory?
It's a fascinating premise.
It really is. We're talking, of course, about Millard Fillmore, the 13th president of the United States. His name, well, it's almost become a cultural shorthand for political mediocrity, hasn't it? As Anna Pryor noted in the Wall Street Journal back in 2010, he's often seen as easily forgotten, maybe even a punchline.
Unfortunately, yes. That's often the perception.
But today, our mission is to peel back the layers of that deep obscurity. We're taking a comprehensive deep dive into the fascinating, complex, and frankly, often misunderstood life and presidency of Millard Fillmore. We'll unpack his incredible and pretty unlikely journey from extreme poverty to the White House. We'll look at his pivotal role in the seismic events leading directly up to the Civil War, and precisely why historians still fiercely debate his place in American memory. It's truly the story of a president caught in an impossible bind, navigating the treacherous waters between his deeply held personal convictions and what he perceived as his unwavering constitutional duty.
Right, and all while facing a national crisis that genuinely threatened to tear the young republic apart.
Exactly.
And to truly understand Fillmore, I mean, to make any meaningful assessment of his character and his decisions, you absolutely have to fully immerse yourself in the profoundly interesting times in which he lived, as the Miller Center of Public Affairs puts it so well. The 1850s were not just tense. They were an absolute powder keg. The nation was grappling, really struggling with the explosive, seemingly intractable issue of slavery's expansion into new territories.
This wasn't just some abstract debate, was it?
Not at all. This was an existential crisis. The very fabric of the Union was under immense, unprecedented strain, threatening to unravel completely. For this deep dive, we've gathered a rich tapestry of sources, detailed biographical accounts that illuminate his personal journey, incisive political analyses that dissect his policy choices, and broad historical narratives that place him within the sweep of American history. We're not just looking to list facts, you know. We want to extract those critical insights that help us understand the why behind his actions, the immense pressures he faced, and the far-reaching consequences of his most difficult decisions. I mean, what stands out to you when you think of a leader making decisions under such extreme, truly existential pressure, knowing that the very future of the nation rests on their shoulders?
It's an almost unimaginable weight.
It really is. That's what we're going to explore today.
Okay, let's unpack this and begin at the very beginning. Our story doesn't start in the halls of power. Far from it, it starts in a literal log cabin. Millard Fillmore was born on January 7, 1800, into what can only be described as extreme poverty, in a rough log cabin nestled in Moravia, part of the beautiful but back then pretty rugged Finger Lakes region of upstate New York.
Right. Very humble beginnings.
Extremely. He was the second of eight children, the oldest son of Phoebe Millard and Nathaniel Fillmore. And his childhood was truly defined by hardship.
Yeah, his parents, Nathaniel and Phoebe, had moved from Vermont, hoping for better opportunities in upstate New York, but their land title in Cayuga County proved defective, a huge setback.
Devastating, really. This forced them into tenant farming in nearby Sempronius, which was a precarious existence at best. Historian Tyler Anbinder painted a vivid and, honestly, rather grim picture of this period, describing Fillmore's early years as one of hard work, frequent privation, and virtually no formal schooling.
It's hard to imagine now. No public schools to speak of in that remote area. Young Millard's education consisted mostly of reading whatever sparse books his family could somehow acquire, and of course the harsh lessons of farm life.
Nathaniel did eventually serve in local offices, even as a justice of the peace, and he famously joked about how to raise a president, cradle him in a sap trough. which, you know, really underscores the rural, difficult origins and the sheer unlikeliness of Millard's eventual rise.
Absolutely. And then at just 14, his father, hoping to secure some kind of future for his oldest son, apprenticed him to a clothmaker, Benjamin Hungerford, in Sparta.
Trying to give him a trade.
Exactly. It was supposed to be an opportunity to learn a valuable skill. However, Fillmore found himself largely relegated to menial labor, you know, cleaning and carding wool, rather than learning the actual craft.
So, not what he signed up for?
Not at all. Utterly unhappy at not acquiring any real skills, he eventually left that apprenticeship. His father, persistent, then placed him in the same trade at another mill in New Hope. But even then, you can sort of see this young man already looking for something more, actively seeking to better his circumstances.
That initial dissatisfaction wasn't just him being difficult then.
No, I think it was really the ignition point for a profound personal drive for self-improvement. While enduring the grueling work at the mill in New Hope, Fillmore sought to educate himself in every spare moment, often late into the night. He scraped together enough money to buy a share in a circulating library, basically an early version of a public library, and he just devoured every book he could get his hands on.
Wow.
This wasn't just a casual interest. It was a desperate thirst for knowledge that would shape his entire life. A real testament to his intellectual hunger, despite the circumstances. It was during this period, in 1819, that he seized an opportunity during idle time at the mill and enrolled at a new academy that had opened in New Hope.
Taking initiative.
Definitely. And there he met and fell in love with a classmate, Abigail Powers. This relationship proved foundational, not only personally, but intellectually. Abigail was herself a school teacher and a voracious reader, and she became a lifelong intellectual companion and confidant for him.
So, a real meeting of minds.
Very much so. And his legal journey, much like his education, began unconventionally and was marked by incredible persistence. In late 1819, his family moved to Montville. Nathaniel, on his wife's astute advice, persuaded the wealthy local judge Walter Wood to take Millard as a law clerk for a trial period.
A big break, potentially.
Huge. Fillmore, always resourceful and determined to be free of the mill, actually earned money by teaching school for 3 months just to buy out the remainder of his mill apprenticeship. Mm-hmm. Shows that drive, right?
Absolutely. Resourceful.
But after only 18 months, he left Judge Wood. He'd earned almost nothing, and they quarreled after he independently advised a farmer in a minor lawsuit for a small sum. Wood apparently didn't like that.
Ah, showing some independence early on.
Exactly. It highlights his early independence, his burgeoning ambition, and his unwillingness to simply remain, you know, under others' thumbs, as biographer Paul Finkelman noted. Nathaniel then moved the family again, this time west to East Aurora, near Buffalo, where his farm finally began to prosper.
Things looking up for the family.
A bit, yeah. At 21, Fillmore taught school there and took on small legal cases that didn't require him to be a licensed attorney yet. He moved to Buffalo the following year to continue his law studies, first while teaching, then in a proper law office. But in 1823, once he was admitted to the bar, he actually declined offers from established Buffalo law firms.
Really?
He instead returned to East Aurora to establish his own practice, becoming the town's only resident lawyer. Finkelman suggested he might have initially lacked the self-confidence for the bigger city of Buffalo, but deeply cherished the independence of running his own show in East Aurora.
Makes sense. Control your own destiny.
Precisely. And then Millard and Abigail finally wed on February 5, 1826. He was 26, she was 27. A true partnership. They would go on to have two children, Millard Powers Fillmore and Mary Abigail Fillmore.
So Fillmore isn't just building a life in a family at this point. He's becoming like an architect of his community, too.
As Buffalo itself rapidly, dramatically rebounding from being burnt by the British during the War of 1812 and just booming as the western end of the newly completed Erie Canal, Fillmore seized every opportunity.
He certainly did. He wasn't just sitting back.
No way. He didn't just establish himself as a prominent lawyer, though he definitely did that. Even bringing his lifelong friend Nathan K. Hall, who started as his law clerk in East Aurora, into his Buffalo practice. He immersed himself in civic life, becoming a real foundational figure.
In what ways?
Well, he helped draft Buffalo's Critical City Charter, co-founded the Buffalo High School Association, became a prominent member of the local Lyceum, and was active in the New York militia, even attaining the rank of major as inspector of the 47th Brigade.
Wow, involved in everything. It really demonstrates this comprehensive engagement with his community, a deep commitment to civic life that went way beyond just, self-interest. What's truly remarkable about Fillmore's early life is this almost superhuman drive for self-improvement, pulling himself out of poverty through sheer intellectual hunger. How much do you think that specific brand of resilience, that self-made man ethos, then defined his approach to leadership, especially when he faced those seemingly insurmountable challenges later as president?
Oh, I think it's absolutely central. That practical, self-taught mindset fundamentally shaped his political philosophy, his whole approach to problem solving. It's no surprise, really, that his initial foray into politics back in the late 1820s led him to the Anti-Masonic Party.
Right, the Anti-Masons. What was their deal exactly?
Yeah. It was a movement largely united by its opposition to General Andrew Jackson, who was a prominent Mason. But it also appealed to those, like Fillmore perhaps, who felt excluded from entrenched power structures. It had this kind of outsider appeal. Fillmore served as a delegate to their conventions, which is actually where he first met the influential newspaper editor, and his future rival, Thurlow Weed.
Ah, the beginning of that relationship, or rivalry.
Indeed. Their initial impression of each other, incidentally, was reportedly quite positive at the time. Fillmore was elected to the New York State Assembly, where he served 3 one-year terms from 1829 to 1831.
Okay, so he's in the state legislature now.
Right. And even though he was in the minority against the dominant Jacksonian Democrats, he proved remarkably effective. He showed this early ability to build coalitions and negotiate. He promoted significant legislation, like allowing court witnesses the option of taking a non-religious oath, which was a pretty progressive step for religious freedom back then, and notably abolishing imprisonment for debt in 1830.
Imprisonment for debt. Wow.
Yeah, it sounds archaic, but it was a real issue. And abolishing it wasn't just a humanitarian gesture. It was a pragmatic reform. Locking people up for debt was economically counterproductive. It truly highlights his early legislative skills and a grounded, practical approach to governance. He showed he could get things done even from a position of relative weakness, always with an eye toward improving the lives of ordinary citizens, you could argue.
That's an impressive start to a legislative career. But here's where it gets really interesting for the burgeoning national political landscape. Fillmore, Weed, and other politically astute figures quickly realized the inherent limitations of the Anti-Masonic Party as a national force. Its platform was just too narrow, too specific, to build a broad coalition needed to win nationally.
Right. It wasn't sustainable long term.
Exactly. So in the mid-1830s, they collaboratively helped form the Whig Party. This was a new, broad-based political entity that united a really diverse group. You had national Republicans, former anti-Masons like Fillmore, and even disaffected Democrats.
A real coalition of the unwilling, almost.
Kind of. What truly bound them together initially was their shared, vigorous opposition to Andrew Jackson, whom they saw as an overreaching executive, a King Andrew. Their platform later expanded to support economic growth through robust federal intervention, things like rechartering the Second Bank of the United States and advocating for federally funded internal improvements like roads, bridges, and, crucially for New York, canals.
So a very different vision from the Jacksonians.
Absolutely. It was a coalition designed to counter what they perceived as Jacksonian executive tyranny and to promote a vision of national economic development driven by federal support.
And Fillmore jumps right into this new party.
He does. He was elected to the U.S. House of Representatives in 1832, serving his first term as a Whig. In Washington, he became a staunch advocate for his home region, vigorously urging the expansion of Buffalo Harbor and privately lobbying Albany for the expansion of the vital state-owned Erie Canal.
Makes sense, representing his constituents.
Definitely. He quickly came under the wing of the hugely influential Massachusetts Senator Daniel Webster, a legal and oratorical giant. They formed a close relationship that would last until Webster's death during Fillmore's own presidency. He was a firm supporter of infrastructure, consistently voting for navigation improvements on the Hudson River and a bridge across the Potomac.
So a reliable Whig vote on those issues.
Very much so. But this period also saw the definitive start of that significant and often bitter rivalry with Thurlow Weed and his rising protege, William H. Seward, both prominent New York Whigs. This rivalry wasn't just about personalities or ambition, though that was part of it.
It was about slavery, wasn't it?
Fundamentally. It was fueled by their differing, increasingly stark stances on slavery. Fillmore, while personally disliking slavery, consistently believed it was beyond the federal government's power to end it in the states where it existed. He clung to a strict constitutional interpretation that he felt compelled to uphold.
Whereas Seward?
Seward argued for a more active federal role, a more overtly moral stance that positioned him against slavery's expansion and eventually its existence. And Weed, strategically aligned with Seward, continually worked against Fillmore's advancement, even blocking his judicial nominations later on. It really demonstrates how, even within a new political party formed out of shared opposition, the deepest ideological divides, particularly on slavery, could just tear at the very fabric of unity.
Yeah, the internal dynamics of the Whig Party were a constant and often debilitating challenge for Fillmore, especially with those growing sectional tensions boiling up. After a brief hiatus from office, during which he focused on his law practice and diligently built up the Whig Party back in New York, he was successfully reelected to Congress in 1836.
Back in the game.
And he soon found himself squarely opposing President Van Buren's sub-treasury economic proposals. This wasn't just some dry economic debate. It represented a fundamental disagreement over the government's role in the economy. Van Buren's plan would have placed government funds in independent depositories that wouldn't lend money, effectively hoarding capital.
And Fillmore disagreed.
Strongly. Fillmore firmly believed that government funds should be lent out, used to develop the country, not locked away. He argued forcefully that Van Buren's plan would hoard the nation's limited gold supply from commerce and stifle the very economic growth the nation desperately needed. He wanted the government's money working for the economy.
Okay, so he's taking strong stances on economic policy.
But definitely. His real leadership, however, truly shone when he returned to Congress in 1837. Though he was unsuccessful in his bid for Speaker in 1841, that position went to a Henry Clay loyalist Fillmore. Fillmore was appointed chairman of the incredibly powerful House Ways and Means Committee.
Wow, Ways and Means, that's huge.
It's massive. Placed him right at the absolute center of national finance and economic policy. His major legislative achievement during this time was the Tariff of 1842. He navigated an incredibly difficult and politically fraught landscape with President John Tyler. Remember, Tyler had been expelled from the Whig Party and was openly hostile to many Whig initiatives.
Right. His accidency, not exactly a team player for the Whigs.
Not at all. Fillmore initially proposed a tariff bill that included the distribution of revenue from federal land sales to the states, which Tyler, predictably, vetoed. But Fillmore didn't just give up.
What did he do?
He then shrewdly prepared a second bill, carefully omitting the controversial distribution clause. Tyler, politically isolated and having alienated pretty much everyone, was basically forced to sign it. This wasn't just a legislative victory. It was a masterclass in political maneuvering.
Outplayed the president.
Pretty much. Fillmore, still relatively young at 42, showed a strategic mind capable of outmaneuvering even a hostile president. It cemented his reputation as a formidable Whig leader, proving he could get things done through sheer tactical brilliance. Robert J. Scarry noted that Fillmore concluded his congressional career at a point when he had become a powerful figure, an able statesman at the height of his popularity.
High praise.
Even his rival, Thurlow Weed, grudgingly called Fillmore able in debate, wise in counsel, and inflexible in his political sentiments. But at just 42, citing exhaustion from Washington life and the constant conflicts around Tyler, he declined to seek re-election in 1842, returning to his lucrative law practice in Buffalo. Stepped away, but certainly remained a very significant political figure.
So he stepped away from Washington. But his political ambition wasn't quite satisfied, it seems. Nor was the party done with it. In 1844, Fillmore sought the vice presidency on the Whig ticket with Henry Clay, a highly coveted position. But Thurlow Weed, ever his rival, again strategically maneuvered against him. Just shows those deep personal and ideological rifts within the New York Whig leadership.
Always Weed pulling strings.
Seems like it. Reluctantly, Fillmore then accepted the Whig nomination for governor of New York, but ultimately lost to Democrat Silas Wright. Biographer Paul Finkelman suggested his hostility to immigrants and his weak position on slavery contributed to his defeat, a sentiment Fillmore himself echoed, somewhat controversially, by blaming foreign Catholics for his loss.
That points towards the know-nothing alignment later.
It does seem like an early indicator of those nativist sentiments he'd later embrace more formally. But even outside direct electoral politics, his civic commitment remained remarkably strong. In 1846, he was instrumental in founding the University of Buffalo, now the prestigious University of Buffalo, and served as its first chancellor until his death in 1874.
Shows that enduring commitment to education.
Absolutely, a consistent thread in his life. Then, in 1847, he achieved a landslide victory, being elected the first directly elected controller of New York. He had been a vocal opponent of the annexation of Texas and the Mexican-American War, viewing it with deep suspicion as basically a land grab to extend slavery into new territories.
A principled stand for him.
Yes, and he won the controller election by the largest margin a Whig candidate for statewide office would ever achieve in New York. Proved his continued popular appeal despite previous losses. As controller, he received widespread positive reviews. He staunchly supported canal expansion, ensured competent management, and notably stabilized currency by requiring state-chartered banks to back their banknotes with New York and federal bonds.
That sounds quite innovative for the time.
It was groundbreaking. A plan Congress eventually adopted nationally in 1864. This wasn't just good governance. It was a brilliant piece of financial innovation that laid the groundwork for more stable national currency. His journey is just a testament to that American ideal of self-improvement, isn't it? Rising from the humblest beginnings to a prominent lawyer, a key figure in Congress, making his mark on national policy and finance. I wonder how much of that early struggle, that practical, self-taught mindset, directly informed his later, often pragmatic, approach to policy and finance in a way that maybe more formally educated politicians might have missed.
That's a fantastic question, and I think it's precisely that practical, grounded mindset combined with his political standing in the absolutely crucial state of New York that led to the unexpected and pivotal twist in his career in 1848. The Whigs, searching for a winning ticket, nominated the Mexican War hero General Zachary Taylor for president.
Old, rough, and ready.
Exactly. But many Northerners were deeply wary of electing a Louisiana slaveholder amidst rapidly escalating sectional tensions, especially since Taylor's political views were quite uncertain. He'd never even cast a vote in a presidential election. He was an outsider in every sense.
A gamble for the Whigs.
A huge gamble. Thurlow Weed, ever the power broker, initially tried to secure a cabinet post for Seward or even place his protege on the national ticket. But Fillmore, rather surprisingly, secured the vice presidential nomination. John A. Collier, a New Yorker strongly opposed Weed, delivered this powerful, though apparently largely exaggerated speech, portraying Fillmore as strong Henry Clay supporter and, critically, indispensable for party unity.
He's positioning him as a unifier.
Right. And crucially, Abbott Lawrence of Massachusetts, a key Taylor supporter who was initially a contender for VP and seen as more accepting of slavery, shifted his support to Fillmore. This was a strategic move, likely to prevent the Whig Party from collapsing right there at the convention, because Northern anti-slavery delegates were threatening to walk out if a more pro-Southern candidate was chosen for VP.
Wow, the party was already that fragile.
Extremely. So there were very sound, if complex, reasons for his selection. Fillmore was a proven vote-getter from electorally crucial New York. He had a strong Whig track record. And perhaps most importantly, his well-known rivalry with the more ardently anti-slavery Seward made him more palatable to Southerners.
A balancing act.
Precisely. Following established custom, Fillmore did not campaign himself. The Taylor-Fillmore ticket narrowly won the election, with New York's electoral votes once again proving absolutely crucial to their victory. Fillmore, hailing from a free state, was generally assumed to oppose the spread of slavery. He clarified his nuanced stance in a widely published letter to an Alabamian, stating that while he personally believed slavery was an evil, the federal government had no authority over it within existing states, only in the territories.
That consistent position again.
Consistent for him, yes, but it highlights the tightrope he was forced to walk in an increasingly divided nation, trying to balance personal morality with constitutional interpretation and political necessity.
Despite the balancing act, and despite promises of influence during the campaign, Fillmore was almost entirely ignored by President-elect Taylor once they won. It was a clear sign of the deep internal divisions within the Whig Party.
Frozen out.
Totally frozen out. Taylor consistently consulted Fillmore's rivals, Weed and Seward, for federal patronage in New York, effectively forming an alliance that directly undermined Fillmore's agreed-upon influence as vice president. Fillmore's situation had become desperate, as one historian vividly put it. His own party's president was actively working against him.
Must have been incredibly frustrating.
Unbelievably so. Despite this profound lack of political influence, Fillmore did find enjoyment in one unexpected aspect of his office. His deep involvement in the administration of the Smithsonian Institution as a member ex officio of its Board of Regents.
Ah, back to his love of learning.
Exactly. It reflected his lifelong love of learning and commitment to education, offering a welcome respite from the political infighting, I imagine.
A small consolation, maybe.
Maybe. But the personal slights were quickly overshadowed by a much larger, rapidly escalating national crisis.
Mm.
Throughout 1849, slavery remained this burning, unresolved issue in the vast territories acquired from Mexico in the recent war. President Taylor advocated for admitting California and New Mexico directly as free states, bypassing the usual territorial process.
Which infuriated the South.
Deeply angered Southerners who felt entirely excluded from this national heritage and feared being permanently outnumbered in Congress. This discord paralyzed Congress, delaying the election of a speaker for weeks as the House divided almost perfectly along sectional lines. Just gridlock.
Sounds familiar.
Doesn't it? Meanwhile, Fillmore actively worked from his marginalized position to counter the weed machine back in New York, building a network of like-minded Whigs and even establishing a rival newspaper to Weed's powerful Albany Evening Journal.
Fighting back.
Trying to. Their long-strained friendship officially ended with a tense public exchange in New York City in November 1849. As vice president, Fillmore was constitutionally bound to preside over the Senate, and thus was forced to sit through some of the most momentous and passionate debates in American history.
What a front-row seat to history, though.
An intense one. He desperately attempted to maintain order amidst incredibly intense sectional conflict. He even privately informed Taylor in May 1850 that he would cast a tie-breaking vote for Henry Clay's comprehensive omnibus bill, that package of proposals aimed at resolving the crisis.
Showing his hand on the compromise.
Yes. But the tension was so extreme that he was even blamed for failing to maintain peace when a shockingly violent physical confrontation broke out on April 17, 1850, between Mississippi's Henry S. Foote and Missouri's Thomas Hart Benton. Foote actually pulled a pistol and pointed it at Benton on the Senate floor.
On the Senate floor. Unbelievable.
Can you even imagine that level of animosity, of the breakdown of civility, to be vice president constitutionally bound to preside over a legislative body where members are pulling out guns on each other and at the same time being actively undermined by your own party's president and political machine? It's a terrifying testament to the sheer volatility of the time, and Fillmore's experience provides a chilling window into the breakdown of compromise that preceded the Civil War.
That volatility, as you just described it, reached a tragic and pivotal climax. On July 9, 1850, President Zachary Taylor died suddenly, likely from gastroenteritis after attending 4th of July ceremonies in the intense Washington heat. His death, especially given his military reputation for toughness and his recent defiant stance against secession, just shocked the nation to its core. It left a power vacuum at the absolute worst possible moment.
Yeah, Fillmore.
Fillmore received formal notification at the Willard Hotel and was swiftly sworn in as president by William Cranch, the chief judge of the federal court for the District of Columbia, on July 10. In an almost unprecedented and certainly bold move for a president who succeeded by death or resignation, Fillmore accepted the resignations of Taylor's entire cabinet.
The entire cabinet.
The whole lot. This wasn't just a formality, it was a clear political statement. He had been so thoroughly marginalized and excluded by them during his vice presidency that he knew he couldn't effectively govern with them. He sought to unite the administration behind his policy direction, specifically a more conciliatory approach to the sectional crisis, one that embraced compromise rather than confrontation.
A total reset.
Completely. He quickly appointed a new cabinet, led by his longtime friend and intellectual mentor, Daniel Webster, as Secretary of State. His old law partner, Nathan Hall, became Postmaster General, a position with significant patronage power. Crucially, the new department heads were largely strong supporters of the compromise, signaling a dramatic shift in direction and a clear commitment to finding a legislative solution to the national crisis.
This is where Fillmore truly stepped into the spotlight then, shedding his marginalization and taking decisive action where his predecessor had largely hesitated. Upon assuming office, Fillmore immediately faced a brewing conflict on the southwestern border. Texas was brazenly attempting to assert its authority over a vast swath of New Mexico territory, even threatening military action.
A real flashpoint.
Absolutely. A dangerous precursor to a potential civil war. Fillmore responded with remarkable firmness. He reinforced federal troops in the area and issued a stark warning to Texas Governor Peter H. Bell to maintain peace, clearly signaling that the federal government would not tolerate unilateral aggression. This is a very firm, early display of presidential authority, an indication that a new, more decisive hand was at the helm.
Okay, so she's handling that crisis. What about the big legislative picture, the compromise?
Right. At this point, Henry Clay's ambitious omnibus bill, designed to address the slavery crisis with one grand legislative stroke, was effectively dead by July 31. All its significant provisions had been stripped away except for the minor organization of Utah Territory. The Grand Compromise had failed.
So back to square one.
Almost. But Senator Stephen A. Douglas of Illinois, a rising star, with Clay's quiet agreement, then proposed a shrewd and ultimately successful strategy. Breaking the omnibus into individual bills that could be passed piecemeal, Fillmore immediately endorsed this strategy, seeing it as the only viable path forward. This approach eventually divided the comprehensive compromise into five separate bills.
Divide and conquer.
Essentially, yes. On August 6, 1850, Fillmore sent a special, powerful message to Congress, revealing the belligerent letter he had received from Governor Bell of Texas and his own firm warning. He urgently implored Congress to defuse the escalating tensions by passing the entire compromise package. With key figures like John C. Calhoun, who had died back in March, and Clay, who was recovering in Newport, Rhode Island, having kind of retreated in despair from the fight, absent from the Senate, Douglas and other allies were able to shepherd the administration-backed bills through.
So the timing worked out.
It did. Each bill passed with support from those who genuinely wanted that particular provision, plus a few critical members determined to see the whole package pass and preserve the Union. The compromise, as signed into law by Fillmore, admitted California as a free state, organized New Mexico and Utah territories with popular sovereignty on slavery, meaning local residents would decide, ended the slave trade in the District of Columbia, and established the Texas-New Mexico boundary, with a substantial payment to Texas for relinquishing its claims.
A complex package.
Extremely. Imagine the immense pressure he was under the nation on the brink, and he's just inherited the presidency. It highlights the immense power of the executive branch in times of crisis and his swift, determined resolve to use it to avert immediate catastrophe.
Yet the very act that brought temporary relief to the nation and that Fillmore believed was essential to save the Union would become the most contentious and enduringly damaging part of his legacy. The toughened Fugitive Slave Act, one of the five bills in the compromise, was just anathema to abolitionists and deeply offensive to many Northerners.
Why was it so controversial?
Its provisions were widely seen as profoundly unjust and morally reprehensible. Anyone aiding an escaped slave faced severe punishment, escapees were denied due process and couldn't even testify on their own behalf, and perhaps most controversially, federal magistrates received a higher payment, $10 for deciding an individual was a slave, than for ruling them free, which was only $5.
A financial incentive to rule against freedom.
Exactly, a perverse financial incentive. This law effectively deputized ordinary citizens in the North to enforce slavery, often against their deepest moral convictions.
Then Fillmore signed it.
He did. Fillmore believed himself duty-bound to enforce it. He saw it not as a personal preference, but as a critical part of the bargain struck in the compromise. A binding contract he felt was necessary to prevent Southern secession, and a solemn obligation stemming directly from his constitutional oath to faithfully execute the laws.
He took the oath seriously.
Extremely seriously. He even held the bill for 2 days until he received a favorable opinion on its constitutionality from his new Attorney General, John J. Crittenden, before signing it. Shows his meticulous attention to legal process. While the compromise brought a temporary fragile truce, the act's enforcement damaged his popularity and also the Whig Party almost beyond repair. The party was already tearing itself apart between its northern and southern factions.
So the backlash was immediate.
Oh, yes. Public outrage and resistance quickly mounted in the North. Cases like the infamous Shadrach Minkins, a fugitive slave taken from federal custody and freed by a Boston mob, were widely publicized, inflaming passions north and south and quickly undermining the brief good feeling that had followed the compromise. This crucial decision, rooted in his belief in the rule of law and constitutional duty, would forever stain his historical reputation for many. It just demonstrates that profound and agonizing conflict between legal obligation and moral conscience in a nation irrevocably divided over slavery. How much do you think Fillmore's strict adherence to constitutional duty, even for a morally repugnant law, ultimately became his greatest political liability?
That's a critical question, isn't it? And it's a tension that runs through his entire legacy. Beyond the monumental and divisive issue of the compromise, Fillmore's presidency saw significant and often progressive activity on both the domestic and foreign fronts. It reveals a president deeply engaged in the practical work of governance, even amidst the crisis.
Like what, for instance?
Domestically, he was a lifelong supporter of national infrastructure development, a core Whig principle. He signed bills to subsidize the Illinois Central Railroad from Chicago down to Mobile, a vital piece of developing the nation's interior, and a canal at Sault Ste. Marie, which would connect Lake Superior to the lower Great Lakes and facilitate immense mineral extraction and commerce.
Big projects.
Huge. In 1851, he famously celebrated the completion of the Erie Railroad in New York by riding the first through train from New York City all the way to Lake Erie, making speeches along the way, urging acceptance of the compromise and extolling the benefits of internal improvements. He also became a vocal advocate for a transcontinental railroad, envisioning a truly connected nation, though it wouldn't actually be authorized until a decade later.
Ahead of his time on that one.
Seems like it. He also showed a significant humanitarian side through his unlikely but deep friendship with the renowned social reformer Dorothea Dix. She wrote to him in August 1850, urging support for her proposal for land grants to finance asylums for the impoverished mentally ill. Though it didn't pass during his term, their correspondence and meetings continued well after his presidency, reflecting his empathy for the vulnerable.
Interesting connection.
And in a somewhat unique and culturally significant move, in September 1850, he appointed Brigham Young, the formidable leader of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, as the first governor of Utah Territory.
Brigham Young, that must have raised some eyebrows.
Oh, I'm sure it did. But in a gesture of gratitude, maybe political shrewdness too, Young named the first territorial capital Fillmore and the surrounding county Millard. On the judicial front, he appointed Benjamin Robbins Curtis to the Supreme Court, a justice who would later famously and courageously dissent in the Dred Scott decision.
A significant appointment in hindsight.
Very. However, he struggled to fill another Supreme Court vacancy in 1852 after Justice John McKinley's death. Several nominations failed or were withdrawn, demonstrating the increasing political polarization even in judicial appointments, another sign of the national breakdown. And on a more personal and enduring note, Fillmore and his wife, Abigail, both avid readers and intellectuals, established the first White House library, gathering a collection of books that reflected their shared love of learning and commitment to culture.
Leaving a cultural mark, too.
Definitely. In foreign policy, Fillmore, though relying on two highly competent secretaries of state, Daniel Webster, and after his death, Edward Everett ultimately made all major decisions himself, asserting strong presidential control.
So he was hands-on with foreign affairs.
Very much so. Most famously, and with far-reaching consequences, he dispatched Commodore Matthew C. Perry on the Perry Expedition to open Japan to the outside world. This addressed concerns of American merchants and shipwrecked sailors and really began Japan's re-engagement with the West. While Perry reached Japan 4 months after Fillmore left office, it was Fillmore's bold initiative and precise instructions that set the course.
A major legacy item there.
Huge. He was also a staunch opponent of European influence in Hawaii, which was a strategic outpost for American whaling and trade. He issued a strongly worded diplomatic message warning France against annexation, which actually caused them to back down, successfully asserting American interests in the Pacific.
Assertive diplomacy.
Yes. He faced particular difficulties regarding the Spanish colony of Cuba. Many Southerners desperately sought to annex it as a slave territory, an ambition that threatened to reignite sectional tensions and potentially embroil the U.S. in war. Venezuelan adventurer Narciso Lopez led three filibustering expeditions to Cuba, recruiting American mercenaries.
Filibustering, like unauthorized invasion.
Pretty much. Unauthorized military campaigns by private individuals, essentially attempts to conquer or destabilize foreign territories for personal gain or political ends. After Lopez's execution by the Spanish and the subsequent killing of several Americans, including the attorney general's nephew, riots erupted in New Orleans, threatening to pull the U.S. into war with Spain.
A dangerous situation.
Extremely. Fillmore, Webster, and Spain worked diligently and diplomatically to resolve the crisis peacefully, skillfully avoiding war, though this measured response further divided his already fractured party. He also met with Lajos Kossuth, the exiled leader of a failed Hungarian revolution who sought U.S. recognition of Hungarian independence. Despite widespread American sympathy for the Hungarian cause, Fillmore, ever the pragmatist, upheld neutrality, refusing to change U.S. foreign policy and avoiding entanglement in European affairs.
Sticking to neutrality.
He did. His administration also successfully resolved American claims against Portugal, dating back to the War of 1812, and smoothed over a dispute with Peru over valuable guano islands, crucial for fertilizer back then. Historians often overlook his remarkable ability to avoid war and resolve potentially explosive disputes with Britain, France, and Spain over Cuba, demonstrating a nuanced and effective diplomatic touch.
So effective behind the scenes.
It seems so. It's easy to get caught up in the big dramatic internal issues of the time, but looking at his diplomatic efforts and extensive domestic programs gives you a far more complete picture of what it truly means to be president. He was laying the groundwork for future global engagement and internal development, even while the nation was tearing itself apart over slavery. It raises an important question. Can a president be effective in multiple areas, demonstrating foresight and diplomatic skill, while facing a deeply divisive issue that ultimately overshadows everything else in the historical narrative?
That is the very essence of the challenge in evaluating Fillmore, isn't it? As his presidency concluded, his personal life was just tragically struck by profound loss, compounding the political burdens he carried. He was the first president to return to private life without independent wealth or a landed estate, a stark contrast to many of his predecessors. He initially intended to resume practicing law in New York's higher courts.
Back to being a lawyer.
That was the plan. However, tragedy struck quickly after he left office. His beloved wife, Abigail, caught a severe cold at President Pierce's inauguration in March 1853, which quickly developed into pneumonia, and she tragically died on March 30th, 1853.
Oh, terrible. Right after leaving the White House.
Just weeks later. Then, little more than a year later, his only daughter, Mary Abigail, died of cholera on July 26, 1854. These profound and successive losses led to a period of deep seclusion and intense mourning for Fillmore. He withdrew from public life for a time.
Understandably. Devastating losses.
Absolutely. He eventually emerged from this personal seclusion in early 1854 as Senator Stephen Douglas's controversial Kansas-Nebraska bill ignited national debate. This proposed opening northern territories to settlement and effectively repealing the cherished Missouri Compromise's limit on slavery, a direct assault on the fragile people.
Screwing things up again.
Massively. Fillmore rallied disaffected Whigs, planning what he cautiously termed a non-political national tour, ostensibly just to preserve the Union. Seeing no viable home for himself in the rapidly emerging Republican Party, which was gaining traction among anti-slavery Northerners, but was too radical for his constitutional views, Fillmore gravitated towards the American Party.
The Know-Nothings.
Better known as the Know-Nothings, yes. This nativist organization, emphasizing anti-immigrant and anti-Catholic policies, gained alarming traction in the mid-1850s, capitalizing on public fears. Fillmore, despite later attempts by some historians to downplay his nativism, sent a letter for publication in January 1855, explicitly warning against immigrant influence in American elections. And he subsequently joined the order, demonstrating a clear alignment with their principles at that time.
So he did embrace the Know-Nothing platform.
The historical record seems clear on that point, yes. From March 1855 to June 1856, he traveled extensively in Europe and the Middle East, reportedly to avoid the escalating and contentious domestic issues back home. During this tour, he had a rather carefully arranged audience with Pope Pius IX, a meeting that required diplomatic maneuvering to avoid Fillmore having to kneel and kiss the Pope's hand, a sign of Catholic deference that would have been politically disastrous for him back in Know-Nothing America.
Delicate diplomacy, even on a personal trip.
Indeed. He also continued his correspondence and meetings with Dorothea Dix, his friend and fellow social reformer. Interestingly, Queen Victoria reportedly called him the handsomest man she had ever seen, a testament to his dignified bearing, perhaps.
Huh. A royal admirer. But while he was still abroad, and largely due to the influence of his loyal allies who now control the American Party, Fillmore was nominated for president in 1856. With Andrew Donaldson as his running mate.
Nominated while out of the country.
Yes, a surprising development for a former president in mourning. Upon his return, he embarked on a series of speeches carefully portrayed as expressions of thanks for his warm reception rather than explicit campaigning. But his true message was a dire warning. Electing the Republican candidate, John C. Fremont, who had virtually no support in the South, would inevitably lead to civil war.
The Union message again.
Absolutely. Both Fillmore and the Democratic candidate, James Buchanan, agreed that slavery was primarily a matter for the states, not the federal government, advocating a position of non-interference. Notably, Fillmore rarely spoke about the immigration question during this campaign, focusing instead almost entirely on the sectional divide and earnestly urging the preservation of the Union above all else.
Trying to find that middle ground.
He was. However, his campaign stagnated and ultimately failed to gain momentum. Many former Whigs, especially in the North, had already abandoned the crumbling Whig Party and joined the burgeoning Republican Party. They viewed Fillmore's moderate, pro-Union stance as hopelessly obsolete in an increasingly polarized nation.
Moderation wasn't selling anymore.
Not in 1856. Biographer Robert J. Scarry suggested that the dramatic and violent events of that year like the bloody conflict in Kansas Territory, Bleeding Kansas, and the brutal caning of anti-slavery Senator Charles Sumner right on the Senate floor amid moderation, seem entirely irrelevant, even cowardly, to many voters. Furthermore, many in the South, fearing a Fremont victory above all else, strategically moved their support to Buchanan's camp to avoid splitting the anti-Fremont vote, effectively dooming Fillmore's chances.
Squeezed out from both sides.
Completely. In the end, Fillmore finished a distant third, winning about 873,000 votes, or 21.6% of the popular vote, and only carrying Maryland's 8 electoral votes. He holds the unique distinction of being the first former president to receive electoral votes after leaving office.
A historical footnote, at least.
Right. Think about the political landscape of the 1850s, a nation completely split, and Fillmore, a former president, desperately trying to stake a claim as a moderate in a world that no longer wanted moderation. It's a stark and somber reminder of how quickly political consensus can collapse and how profoundly difficult it is for leaders to adapt when the very ground shifts beneath them, demanding uncompromising stances where none seemed possible before.
With his political career largely ended by his decisive 1856 defeat, Fillmore found his financial worries permanently resolved in 1858 when he married Caroline McIntosh, a wealthy widow. Their combined wealth allowed them to purchase a magnificent mansion on Niagara Square in Buffalo, where they lived the remainder of his life.
So, a comfortable retirement, finally.
Financially, yes. There, the Fillmores devoted themselves to entertaining and philanthropy, becoming leading citizens of Buffalo. They generously supported almost every conceivable cause, including the Buffalo General Hospital, which he had helped found, and the Buffalo Fine Arts Academy, further cementing his legacy as a civic leader in his adopted hometown.
Still involved locally.
Very much so. In the tumultuous 1860 presidential election, he voted for Democrat Stephen Douglas, still hoping, perhaps, for a moderate solution. When the secession crisis dramatically unfolded after Abraham Lincoln's election, Fillmore initially refused to take part, feeling he lacked the necessary influence, a poignant reflection on his political standing by then. However, he quickly condemned President Buchanan's perceived inaction and publicly called secessionists traitors, a strong statement for a former president.
Taking a stand for the Union.
Yes. He even hosted Abraham Lincoln in Buffalo en route to his inauguration, sharing a common concern for the Union. Once the Civil War began, Fillmore unequivocally supported Lincoln's efforts to preserve the Union. He notably commanded the Union Continentals, a Home Guard Corps in upstate New York made up of men over 45 that trained to defend Buffalo and later had the solemn duty of guarding Lincoln's funeral train as it passed through the city.
So he supported the war effort.
He did, but with some nuance. In early 1864, he gave a speech calling for magnanimity toward the South, an appeal for reconciliation that the Lincoln administration, fighting for its political life in an election year, saw as a direct attack. He was unjustly criticized as a copperhead, that derogatory term for Northerners who sympathized with the Confederacy, and even a traitor.
Harsh criticism.
Very harsh. Importantly, he supported Democrat George B. McClellan in the 1864 election. He genuinely believed that the Democratic plan for an immediate cessation of fighting, with slavery potentially intact as a means to an end, was the quickest and best chance to restore the Union, fearing the immense human cost of prolonged war.
A controversial position in 64.
Extremely. After Lincoln's assassination in April 1865, his house was infamously vandalized with black ink for not being draped in mourning, though he was reportedly out of town at the time. It highlights the intense emotions and political divisions of the era. He later supported President Andrew Johnson's Reconstruction policies, believing the nation needed quick reconciliation rather than punitive measures. Millard Fillmore died on March 8, 1874, aged 74, after suffering two strokes, and was laid to rest at Forest Lawn Cemetery in Buffalo.
So we've explored his entire life, his improbable rise, and his tumultuous presidency, but what about his enduring legacy? It's rare for a president to be so thoroughly well lambasted by history. Historians and political scientists usually rank Fillmore among the worst and least memorable U.S. presidents.
That's the common assessment, yes.
His handling of slavery, particularly his unwavering enforcement of the Fugitive Slave Act, often leads to descriptions of him as weak and inept. Harry S. Truman famously and somewhat crudely called him a weak, trivial thumb twaddler and partially responsible for the Civil War. Biographer Paul Finkelman notes his vision was myopic and he was always on the wrong side of the great moral and political issues. His name has undeniably become a byword in popular culture for easily forgotten and inconsequential presidents, often invoked as the epitome of presidential mediocrity.
It's a heavy weight of negative judgment.
It really is. But as with all complex historical figures, there are crucial counterarguments and nuances that challenge this harsh assessment. And that's why we take these deep dives, right, to see the whole picture.
Absolutely. There's always more to the story.
Elbert B. Smith, for example, argues he was a conscientious president who meticulously honored his oath by enforcing the Fugitive Slave Act rather than governing by personal preferences or moral qualms that he believed were outside his constitutional remit. Smith contends that Fillmore's pro-Southern reputation is largely undeserved.
So, focusing on his adherence to the law.
Exactly. Stephen G. Calabresi and Christopher S. Hugh deem him a faithful executor of the laws for good and for ill, highlighting his adherence to legal process above all else. Benson Lee Grayson highlights his administration's often overlooked ability to avoid international problems and resolve numerous disputes with Mexico, Portugal, Peru, and most crucially with Spain over Cuba peacefully and without losing face, a testament to his diplomatic skill.
Those foreign policy successes we discussed.
Right. Frederick Greenstein and Dale Anderson praise his forcefulness in handling the Texas-New Mexico border crisis, his decisive replacement of Taylor's cabinet, and his effective advancement of the compromise itself, seeing those as acts of strength, not weakness.
A different interpretation of the same events.
Precisely. Political scientist James E. Campbell argues historians have underrated him and that his compromise of 1850, quote, did more good than harm for the nation and the anti-slavery cause by crucially delaying civil war, allowing the industrializing North to further consolidate its economic and military strength before the conflict eventually erupted.
The buying time argument.
Exactly. Smith also argues his association with the Know-Nothings looks far worse in retrospect, suggesting he wasn't primarily motivated by nativism, despite his 1855 letter, but rather by his consistent belief in preserving the Union at all costs, even if it meant aligning with unsavory groups.
Trying to contextualize the Know-Nothing phase.
Yeah. And despite his abysmal historical ranking, sites do honor him. There's his birthplace with a replica log cabin, his East Aurora house still stands, and a statue stands proudly outside Buffalo City Hall. In 2010, the U.S. Mint even released a presidential $1 coin bearing his likeness, and Fillmore Street in San Francisco is named for him.
So not entirely forgotten.
Not entirely. The Miller Center of Public Affairs concludes that Fillmore's career spanned the tortuous course toward the two-party system. The Whigs were not cohesive enough to survive the slavery imbroglio, and his enforcement of the Fugitive Slave Law all but guaranteed that he would be the last Whig president, contributing directly to the ultimate division that led to civil war. This spectrum of opinion really makes you wonder, how do different historians weigh a president's duty versus their personal morality or political skill versus the ultimate outcome of their policies? It's complex. We've taken a deep dive into the extraordinary, often tragic, and deeply contentious life of Millard Fillmore, a man born into the most extreme poverty who, through sheer force of will, rose to the highest office in the land, becoming the last Whig president.
Quite a journey.
An unbelievable journey. We've explored his tireless efforts in law and politics, his unexpected ascent to the presidency through the death of a sitting president, and his fraught high-stakes navigation of the Compromise of 1850. That package of legislation meticulously designed to hold a rapidly fracturing nation together.
But which, ultimately?
Ultimately, through the Fugitive Slave Act, contributed to his enduring historical controversy and public condemnation.
What's truly fascinating here, and what Fillmore's story forces us to confront, is the profound paradox he embodies. A figure often dismissed, forgotten, even mocked, yet absolutely central to arguably the most dangerous and decisive decade in American history before the Civil War.
Right at the heart of the storm.
Exactly. He was, by all accounts, a meticulous and conscientious executor of the laws, a man who saw his constitutional oath as paramount. Yet, that very conscientiousness in enforcing the morally repugnant Fugitive Slave Act earned him the scorn of countless citizens then and the overwhelming condemnation of most historians since. His story forces us to grapple with the brutal trade-offs leaders sometimes face, especially when deeply held personal morality clashes head-on with the perceived or legally mandated demands of the Constitution and the desperate plea for national unity.
It's a tough spot for any leader.
An impossible spot, perhaps.
So, what does this all mean for you listening right now? Millard Fillmore's story isn't just a dusty page from history. It challenges us to look beyond simplistic labels like worst or best, and to ask a fundamental, ethically resonant question. When faced with a morally repugnant law that is nevertheless perceived by a leader as absolutely crucial to preserving national unity and constitutional order, does that leader's faithful execution of the laws ultimately earn them condemnation or commendation in the long arc of history?
A really difficult question.
It is. And in our own time, when leaders are constantly grappling with deeply unpopular or ethically fraught policies, how do we evaluate their choices? Especially when those decisions are made in the name of a greater, even if uncertain, good. It's a question that continues to resonate, challenging our understanding of leadership and morality far beyond the 13th presidency.